You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we will be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenter Guy Routledge, who is co-founder of the Food Rush.
That's right.
There is a lot of excitement in my voice. I can barely contain myself. First of all, I've got two of my favourite boys here. I'm not really allowed to say that to me. Sexist or condescending, I think, but two of my favourite people in food, which is Russell and Albert from 5D Chocolates, who've been on the show before. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sue.
Hi, Sue. And of course, oh, what a shame, they bought stuff with them.
Some lovely chocolates to taste, which
is fantastic. But I'm sorry, guys, but it's such a great pleasure to have Patricia Michelson.
Michelson.
Getting that right. La Fromagerie, one of my favourite places. I used to work just along Baker Street, and then I discovered Marylebone High Street, and then I discovered your shop. Well, that was it then. I was in there all the time, and the Ginger Pig, which is next door. La Fromagerie, so we're going to be talking about cheese.
Some lovely cheese, some lovely chocolate.
And very, very kindly, Patricia's bought all sorts of cheese, and she's even labelled them, just in case I forget. Yeah, well, I was going to say, just in case I forget.
Well, there's so many wonderful different kinds of varieties and flavours and places that you can... You know, it all starts to look the same, even though it all tastes completely different. So, yeah, very excited to try some of that.
So just when we start, Patricia, can you give us a little bit about your background? Because you have a real love of cheese. Where did that start?
Well, it's not something that I inherited or anything like that. It started because I skied very badly.
Really?
I was skiing in Méribel in the Savoie, and it's the Trois Vallées, if anybody knows it. And it was a particularly bad day. It had suddenly turned bad, and they call a whiteout, where the sky sort of touches the ground. And I took a tumble and then got myself back up, but didn't know where I was, and I couldn't hear the party that I was with because the sound suddenly goes flat.
I mean, I've been in a whiteout. It's quite frightening.
It's very frightening.
And you literally can't tell the difference between the sky and the ground.
No,
it's really, really disorientating.
No, it's very disorientating. So I spent the rest of the day trying to get down this mountain, and I went off-piste very badly, and I taught myself how to do a mogul run.
What is that?
Well, all those little bumps, trying to get over them. Yes, and through the trees, and I was having the best time, as you can imagine.
Yeah. That sounds
terrifying.
I
was getting really, really, really scared. But anyway, I got myself down eventually with the help of a very nice young couple from France who showed me exactly where to go when I got to a certain point, and I could hear the buzzing of the overhead cables. And I got myself down, and it was like 5:30 in the evening. It was the whole day. It's like five hours. It was tough. Anyway, I walked through the village in Chaudun and passed the cheese shop called La Fromagerie. And I went in with my last 10 francs. That tells you how long ago it was. And I bought a little piece of the local cheese, which is called Beaufort. And I bought the Beaufort Chalet d'Arpage, which is the high mountain summer milk cheese, and I munched it on my way back, relieved, and I thought, this is absolutely delicious. Why is it giving me so much pleasure? You know, it's lifting my spirits after a shocking day. And the next day, my husband, to appease me, because he didn't come to find me, he took me down.
Good conversation.
I often quiz him on that one.
Yeah.
He took me to Moutier, which is the main village, to the local market and the local cheesemaker, Monsieur Roudet, which I worked with for many years afterwards. Went to his store and saw the cheese and said how much I liked it. My French is still very bad, but it's got me by. But I asked him, I said, oh, I'd love to take a piece of cheese home. So he said, oh, madame, I'll bring it up to your chalet. I said, oh, you don't have to do that. No, I would love to. We can have a cup of coffee together. I thought, all right then. And so a couple of days later, he arrives in his little truck and brings out what I hoped I'd said was a piece of cheese. What I had said was a pièce, which is a whole wheel.
Amazing.
Okay, so here it was.
How are you going to fit that in your suitcase?
You know, he'd come hours out of where he was to up to our chalet, and with this cheese. And I said to my husband, have we got enough to pay for this? We can't just tell him to take out two kilos, can we? You know, it's never going to happen. So we scrabbled together some money and shoved it in the back of the car and took it home, and I put it in my garden shed.
Amazing.
And when was this? What year was this?
1990.
I think people forget there's been such a renaissance in food that people forget that actually the cheese available to you then was definitely supermarkets. I think
there was Paxton and Whitfield. There were a few, but there was a French cheese shop in South Kensington, for instance. Mm. And they had all the cheeses there, but you didn't know what they were. Mm. You'd go in and say, what's this? Oh, it's goat's cheese. Where's it from? The Loire. Give me some more information.
And now, of course, people are so used to seeing different types of cheeses. Mm. But, I mean, then it was quite unusual, surely.
Oh, yes, it was. And for somebody to actually start a little business, because that 16-hour journey home, I was chatting to my husband saying, you know, what are we going to do with this blooming thing? And, how many fondues can we make? But, you know, it suddenly dawned on me, because I love cooking and I loved entertaining. We were always giving dinner parties, lunch, everything, you know, it was all going on. I thought, why can't I get cheese like this at home? And is there a way of actually starting a little business from home, where I can put cheese on a tray and once a week go around Northwest London delivering a lovely cheese for the weekend? And that's basically what I was going to be doing. Yeah.
So your first shop was in Highbury Park, and I think you opened it in September 1992?
It was, yes, because 1991 I was doing the farmer's market. Well, not farmers, it was the market at Camden Lock, which...
Now it's a huge food destination.
It was big then, but it had a lot of cred then, because a lot of artisans, well, usually in the fashion business, used to start there, and music. But I had a cheese store there. And because we were then moving from the house where I had my shed, we then had to decide we needed somewhere to put the cheese. So in the local paper, I saw a six-month let, £80 a week.
Oh, wow.
In Highbury Park.
How times have changed in terms of stuff like that.
And I thought, well, I can just about manage that with the, you know, the deliveries I'm doing and the market. So I took it and I went to Highbury Park. It's called Highbury Barn, affectionately. And I could see a really good butcher, Mr. Godfrey. And there was a very good fruit and veg. There was a little deli. And I thought, I can fit in here.
That's good then, because that means that there is a community of people that are looking for good food.
It's one of those,
because
location
is important, isn't it? Don't you think?
Of course it is. But also who's surrounding you as well. And I thought, right, this is an area that people go to all the time to do shopping. I can fit in there. If there's a good butcher, there's a good chance that they want to have good cheese as well, because, you know, if you have a nice roast afterwards, you'd have some cheese afterwards. And I was going to open just for about 3 days a week, because I had my market at the weekend. I was delivering to a few restaurants by then. But within a week of opening, I was down to 5 days a week. And then a month later, it was, you know, I gave up the market after about 6 months, and I
concentrated
on the shop.
And don't forget then, no online ordering really as such.
No,
then,
no.
At all.
Internet at all. And everything that I did was, you know, it was literally through having great information in the shop that I could give out newsletters and things like that. But my first customer, I have to tell you, when I opened the doors, was Nigel Slater.
Oh, wow.
I mean, what luck. I mean, sometimes serendipity.
That's a great endorsement from the beginning.
So he was just starting his Observer Guardian
columns.
And he started using our cheese for that.
And do you think it would be just as easy for somebody in this day and age to open a physical store in the location, you know, the kind of place that you have? Or do you think that that is just not even an option anymore because of the way that we all want the convenience and we all want to order online and it doesn't matter about the community
well,
anymore?
Well, the store at Camden was really a pop-up.
Hmm.
So there you go. I had the first pop-up.
The same thing that we're doing now, yeah.
So yes, I would do a pop-up. If I was doing it now, I would do a pop-up. I would be online. I would have a lovely website of some kind to do some things. And I would be going around everywhere, you know, getting my cheese out. It's so much easier now.
And I think a lot of it is education as well, because if you opened your, you know, your first shop and people weren't exposed to a lot of different cheeses, you have to go and see somebody to talk about it, because you don't know. I mean, that's the great thing about having a proper, good local wine merchant, is talking to somebody about what you like and what they recommend. It's the same as cheese, isn't it?
It is, but you have to remember, I didn't know very much.
I bet you soon learned, though.
I love that. You know, you had the passion, you just went and did it anyway.
I just loved it. Suddenly thought, I'm going to get into this, and I you know, talk to anybody that I could find to talk to me about stuff like that.
And so is that how you learn? Through talking to other people who were experts?
Yes, and then visiting.
And the suppliers. It's
physically visiting people and going off to France and with my bad French and visiting a cheesemaker, Monsieur Roudet, who spoke like two words of English. But, you know, I went to see how he made the cheese. I'd go off skiing with my husband and then we'd go and visit a few other places. And we got to know who to go to. And my husband was very supportive because he came into the business. He suddenly saw that there was, hey, you know, we can do something with this. And he came in with me.
Now, I have been to your Moxon Street shop quite a lot, which is just off Marylebone High Street, which was your second shop.
Mm.
Now, when you go in there, for people who haven't gone in there, you've actually got a walk-in cheese room.
Well, we've always had a walk-in.
Yeah, now for me, a lot of people will talk about cheese, but actually it's not just the temperature of cheese that's important, it's keeping the atmosphere moist. And did you make that decision straight away that keeping the cheese was the most important thing?
Yes, because I wanted to only do originally Alpine cheeses, but then I said, no, I want them to be raw milk cheeses and I want to keep them in an atmosphere and condition that they're kept in where they are. And because I had my little shed, I transferred the shed into the first tiny shop, literally, took the old rattly...
You took the wooden shed and put it into the store.
I took everything out of it. You know, there was the rattly cooling unit that
amazing.
I was third hand, probably from a beer cellar. there were the IKEA shelves and there were my straw mats and, you know, we put it together. And you walked into that little shop and it was cold. And I had my little humidity thing going on as well, no matter what time of year it was. And it was freezing in winter and freezing in summer. So I used to have little shawls to give people if they came in summer because they had sleepers. So when I moved across the road to the present shop, I said, right, we're going to have a nice walk-in cheese room there. The same thing, because I find that it's the easiest place to keep the cheese. Rather than put it into fridges, which have massive amount of fans drying them out and pulling away all the atmosphere to keep it cold.
And is there an issue with the vibrations as well? Because I've heard this from a wine guy who was saying don't keep wine in the fridge because the vibrations can actually cause, like, not damage to the wine, but it can, you know, move things around. Is there a similar problem with the cheese in the fridge?
It's a thought. I've never heard of that before, but it's a thought.
Guy, you just made that up.
Yeah,
I did.
Who knows?
I'm sure my wine guys.
But you know that wine had travelled across Europe to get to your, you know, the shop to then go to your fridge. So I don't think it's going to matter.
Probably be fine.
Yeah.
So we've got all these lovely cheeses, and the great thing about a walk-in, you know, sort of cheese area is, of course, it's a little bit of theatre, which is part of the retail thing. But you can actually go in and see all your cheeses properly, as opposed to them all being wrapped up in a supermarket with labels on.
The important thing, the vital thing for me when I started was to have information for people, to let them know where it comes from, who made it, what the milk type is, whether it's traditional rennet or something else, and a good tasting note, how it tastes and what else can go with it, such as wine or bread or whatever. Because I never had that luxury when I was going shopping. You know, they say, oh, it's a Brie and it's south of Paris. What does it taste like? Well, soft.
It tastes like Brie.
But that's really what people want. They want that information.
That little person. It's the same as you used to go into a wine shop and what would you do? How would you choose a wine? Because there's nothing on there. So you choose it. Oh, that's a nice label.
How else do you make a decision? Yeah.
And the French are very bad at giving any information on labels anyway.
Yeah, it's always very
confusing. They're always hidden, they're hiding things. They won't even tell you the grape style or anything.
But you just have to know these things.
Yeah.
But is it similar in cheese as well? Sorry, I was just going
to... She wants to dive in.
I think Sue wants to eat some cheese.
No. What I was going to say is you bought some lovely cheese for us to taste, but just for a minute, I'm just going to go over to the chocolate thing. So both Albert and Russell, how important is it for you to showcase your chocolates as well so that people can see? And then you've got tasting notes for your chocolate too. Do you see it as an education thing?
Yeah, it's definitely an education thing. I think people eat with their eyes. So you've got to make food look appealing, tasty, look interesting, because so many people, it's like when you meet someone for the first time, you make a decision about that person within a few seconds. And I think food is much the same. If you see something that looks really good, you want to actually eat it even more.
So going back to your cheese, now you've brought some with you. You don't just do English cheese, do you?
No.
Though you've got, so you will source, you'll go to French markets and Italian markets and
Germany
and work out the best of whatever it is. Is that
I'm looking for artisan, handmade, traditional cheese made by real people rather than, you know, using hopefully milk from their own herds.
So the provenance is really important to you.
That word, yes.
That word.
Yeah. But this is 26 years of doing this, and every time I hear it, I think like it's a new word. But it's very important that people know where things come from, I think, in order to enjoy them. You know, why does cheese taste, you know, in Holland, why does it taste like that? Because of the way it's made and the style of trying to keep that cheese from getting molds on it, so they put this waxed rind on it, and you know, these are all things that make you not only enjoy it but also appreciate it a bit more. And I just like to showcase everything, because England's got amazing cheese. I bought one very, very new one, and a blue cheese, which is from a very well-known cheese producer called Cropwell Bishop. But it's a cheese that is very much softer and more in the continental style that showcases how they can.
So shall we have a little taste of does it say Bix there that you've written?
Yes, Bix.
And what is that exactly?
That's a little triple cream cheese. And that's,
do you boys want to have a quick dig in?
Grab a plate and dig in.
We'll have a little taste as we're going along.
Well, we should really taste. Oh, I'm going to be very naughty.
We should do it in the wheel, shouldn't we? Actually, you're right. Yes.
Right, we should really taste. The first one is the goat's cheese, the Bondon Gatin, and it's from West France. And it's always good to taste a goat first.
Yes, sorry, I should have done that.
Because it neutralises your palate and refreshes your palate as well.
And just to go through what goat's cheese is. Goat's cheese generally is a very, very young cheese. It's made quite quickly.
Yes.
Some of my favourite goat's cheeses have got that very nice slight lemon edge to them sometimes.
Yes, the acidity.
Which one's this one?
This is actually has a little bit of age to it, because I like you to taste the nuttiness of it.
And you get that sort of crumbliness with the goat's
cheese. Be able to taste the rind as well, because the rind on cheese is very important. It's probably the most important thing that you look at, or you should look at, is because the cheese ripens from the outside into the centre, not from the centre out. So what goes on the outside of a cheese is very important. You know, if you saw that with lots of very hairy moulds on it, we call it poil de chat, cat hair, you think, oh, that's been kept in too wet an atmosphere. This has got nice, close to the cheese. It's not peeling off like an orange. So, you know,
I'm not used to seeing goat's cheese with that type of skin. I mean, it almost looks like you would get on a camembert or something like that in terms of its, you know.
It's a slight bloomy rind. It's got a little bit of ash on it as well, which you can't really see. But it all contributes to the flavour. So it's giving you a variety of flavours.
And how long would this been aged?
So we get this in after about 2 weeks. And it's been with us a further 2 weeks.
And okay. To put that in context, I can't speak to meat and cheese. Mm. To put that in context, you know, some goat's cheese can be with you after 2 days, can't they?
Mm.
Mm. So this is quite an aged goat's cheese.
Because this is quite firm compared
to some.
It's
not aged, it's just
the way they make it.
A point, you know, it's at the right level.
Mm.
And how would you keep goat's cheese? Would you, because that's reasonably cold.
Mm.
It's not like you'd have a soft cheese, we might put it out for a little bit more.
What's the best temperature? Well, on days like today, which is great for cheese because it's dull, overcast, and it's a lot of humidity. It's not good for my hair.
It's not good for the soul, but it's good for the cheese.
It's not good for my hair. But you can keep that on the kitchen counter quite happily. If you want to keep it in, I'll tell you the biggest piece of news for you is how to keep cheese right. This is really easy, especially good cheese. So you get a Tupperware box. You line your Tupperware box with a dampened J cloth. You wrap your cheeses in waxed paper and then you put them side by side. And then you can either put the lid on and put it in the fridge because you're going to keep it for a few days. But if you think you're going to keep it longer, like over Christmas when it's like a 10-day thing, put a couple of sugar cubes. Just white, ordinary sugar cubes into the box. Okay. Close the box and then put it in the lower part or the, you know, wherever you keep the
salad drawer. Mm-hmm.
Salad drawer, whatever. And it will keep very nicely. Take out your cheese whenever you want it. You take off the wrapping. Always put new wrapping on when you replace your cheese. You have created in that little chamber, that box, is a humidity chamber because the dampness of the cloth gives you the wetness the humidity, and then the sugar absorbs any of the odors and other things that might change the flavor of your cheese.
Have read loads and loads and loads about cheese and all sorts of things. I have never heard that is the optimum way to keep cheese.
That is pure gold. You heard it here. But it's in my book, so if anybody wants to buy my book. But
I'm sure they do after that.
It's simple things like that that help you keep your cheese properly and that you don't you don't get disappointed because often you buy something, you can't eat the whole thing all at once and you wonder, how am I going to keep it? And then you find it in the back of the fridge, this horrible little
And the absolute worst thing you can do is wrap it in plastic.
Well, you can use the cut surfaces, like for the Beaufort. You can cover those in a cling just to keep them from drying out. Mm-hmm. But always remember, as I said, cheese ripens from the outside in, so the crust needs to be respected. So don't over wrap that.
Respect the cheese. Sue.
Respect the cheese. I'm going to respect the cheese by moving on from my goat's cheese. I've just had goat's cheese, and again, if you are doing a tasting at home, this is what you should do. Really, is go from the least, you know.
Yeah,
sort of
we start a little journey. Yeah. So try the Bix now, because that's the little that one there.
This one. There.
It's
very soft.
It's soft and gooey. Ooh.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, I know. See, you were just saying, Russell, eat that. You know, if your eyes
help
first.
Yourself.
Wow! So I've never heard of this one.
Right. So it's from Nettlebed. Nettlebed cheese, Rosie. They make the most wonderful hard cheese as well. But I think the Bix is superb. Yeah.
Wow.
So different to the first one. So we're getting a real contrast here.
You know, it's near Oxford, so wonderful grazing area. Okay, so it's going to have lovely lush grass.
And this is lush cheese.
Yes, and it goes into the cheese, yeah.
But you can almost taste the freshness of it.
You can't you?
And it's it's so soft compared to the previous one, the goat's cheese, and it almost felt like picking up a runny truffle or something, like a chocolate truffle.
But absolutely, you could make that gorgeous.
You could make that. That would make a fantastic chocolate
it's
cheese.
It's as if you can taste Oxfordshire in that cheese.
Yes,
it's got the.
But seriously, you can, and we're not exaggerating. Mm. It does. Mm. You can almost taste the grass.
It's a small cheese. It's only about, I think, 180 grams. And so it's very, very difficult to get it to that stage. And often you'll see it in shops and it's quite hard because they've kept it too cold.
And is that...
They've not had the, you know... but we've got to... We have our own ripening rooms where we do all
make
our...
Make sure it's absolutely...
Yes, all our maturing.
And do you have different rooms for different temperatures for different cheeses?
We have four rooms.
Right, okay.
They're all interconnecting, so that we don't have to keep coming in and out, so we can work in there quietly all through the day. And that one is actually in the goat room. So it's cold, but there is a nice amount of humidity, not too much. Mm. And if it comes in too young and it needs time, we then put it into another room to start it off and then bring it into another room. We can move them around the rooms.
So who's the producer for that? But you can get it at La Fromagerie, but
Producer? It's Nettlebed Creamery, and they're based in Kingham, which is very, very pretty, in Oxford. And you can get it, in all good cheese shops.
Mm. Well, we're going to be hard pushed to beat that.
We're going to try.
So what do you suggest next?
So now you go on to a hard cheese, and let's try the Beaufort. This is my favourite. This is the one that started the whole story.
It's Montgomery cheddar. It's one of my favourites because it's got such an amazing long aftertaste. Is this just a normal cheddar? No. So it's a hard cheese.
No, it's a French Gruyère.
French Gruyère?
Mm. Yeah.
Ah, so you haven't tasted this. All right, okay, screw it.
So this is a High Mountain, so it's summer milk, and it's only...
Sorry, I'm laughing because all Albert's doing at the moment is just nodding his head going, yum, yum, yum.
That's all I'm doing as well, to be fair.
I'm not a big fan of cheese. I mentioned earlier before in one of our early talks. But this is absolutely delicious. Mm. You say it's like Gruyère, but it's obviously not Gruyère.
No,
exactly, but
no, it's more elegant, it's more feminine than that.
A lot more sophisticated. And Gruyère, I love actually, but
it's really nutty.
But if you tasted that with a glass of Chardonnay, an oaked Chardonnay,
that's what we're missing here.
This is what you're missing.
Did you not bring one with you?
I was going to, but I thought it might not be fair to us all get.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, we've done that before, for sure.
Now
this is lovely.
Again, with a hard cheese.
So what do you get? You get salt.
And nuttiness, yeah.
Sweetness, and you get that lovely, rich
it's
taste.
Beautifully sweet.
And it makes your mouth water.
It does.
And it's so different from the other two.
Really,
and it's given you that moment of having the light nuttiness of the start, the rich, creamy, dense, then on to this, which is much more fruity. And then you would then... go dive into the Torta de Hesa, which is a Spanish cheese from Extremadura.
Can I just explain that, Patricia? So we've got a round wheel of cheese there. It's about, I don't know, 10 centimetres high. Mm. 10 centimetres.
Less than that, I would say.
Less than that. And then
couple of inches.
It's slightly gorgeously creamy in the middle. Are we dunking on that one? We're going to dunk.
Yes.
And how would you keep that?
I would try and eat that as quickly as possible.
How would you keep it?
I wouldn't keep it.
You wouldn't.
Okay.
Once you've opened it, that's why it's not too big. Mm. So you could share that out. I mean, you could sort of cut it in half if you wish to, but...
That's amazing after dinner, isn't it? That people
would
It's such a ceremony as well. You wanted to sort of get friendly, community sort of orientated. So the question that springs to mind for me is that we have all these amazing cheeses here, and yet the vast majority of people only eat cheddar. So,
do they?
Well, in our notes here, we've got 55% of the UK are cheddar eaters, of 98%, I think it is, of households that buy cheese. So I guess if you want to get into a thriving market, cheese is a good place to be because everyone's buying it. But there is, there seems to be this huge appetite for cheddar.
It's the UK's favourite cheese. accounting
when there's
for
so much more 50, interesting stuff out there.
55% of household purchases, you know, and yet there are over 700 named cheeses in the UK. And you're sourcing even wider afield than that.
Yes, we go even to... you just missed by a day because I'm going to collect the American cheeses ready to be collected. It comes over every couple of months, artisan American cheese. Mm. So that's sheep's milk that you're that, and it's with a thistle rennet, so it's vegetarian as well.
Oh, right.
So that's why you get that little
It's a bit of a sharpness in there somewhere.
Yeah, that little sort of wacky flavour coming through. Yeah.
I have to say the Bix still edges it for me on that one.
It's very special,
I think
the Bix.
I find that spectacular.
Yeah.
And then you've got a blue cheese.
Can you explain why
is blue cheese blue as opposed to other things in the way it's made?
It's the mould, the Roquefortaine mould that they put into it. And it, basically what it is, in the old days, and still some Roquefort is made that way, where they have a bread, usually a sourdough bread, that they allow to get completely mouldy. And then they rub it to get little powdery residue on it. And then rub it over a cheese, a normal cheese, and then pierce it to allow the air and the bacteria around the cheese that's on the cheese and in the air to go through into the cheese, and then it spreads that mould through it. It parslids.
So it's something that is introduced into the cheese intentionally in a certain type of mould in a certain type of way.
Yeah, and some we've got a cheese called a Bleu de Termignon from Savoie, and it's made only in August, and then left for a long time, and it gets a very biscuity rind or crust on the outside, which they pierce. And within the cave that it's kept in, because there's so much bacteria in the air, once they've pierced it, all that bacteria in the air then goes into that cheese. It's not had any bacteria added to it, but it gradually gets a little bit of blue going through it. To give it the flavour.
I do like blue cheese.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, especially with a nice glass of port or red wine or something.
Yeah, well, or white.
I'd say that I actually really like dessert white with cheese.
I've learnt to
do that, thank you, because it doesn't feel intuitive. It doesn't feel the natural thing to do. And yet, if you've got an incredibly salty cheese, like I'm guessing this is...
The sweetness can
really
kind of...
really works well.
This is nice to go with chocolate.
Cheese to go with chocolate.
This is going to be interesting because I'm not a fan of blue cheese.
Okay.
So I'm going to try it anyway.
But weirdly, you've said you're not a fan of any of those and you like them all. So
I like them all so far, so that's good news.
It's all good cheese.
We don't believe you, Albert, I'm afraid. Come here saying you don't like cheese. Now,
it's lovely and creamy, but...
You could have that with a milk chocolate. It would be nice.
Yeah, so just to explain that, I've got that as very creamy to start with, which I find quite unusual with blue cheese. And then I've got the blue coming through. And now I'm just getting salt, actually.
Yeah, the salt definitely comes in at the end.
It's a Cropwell Bishop.
Who normally make a Stilton.
They make a very sort of manly Stilton. It can be quite, I'm a big fan of that. Full on. And then they've made this Beau Vale, which is very, very popular with everybody.
Personally, I'm not a big fan of blue cheese, but that one is very mild, subtle. Yeah.
It is
delicious.
Mild,
it's very delicious.
Now, I'm afraid I like the old... it's just gone straight in my hand. What's the Stilton, the English Stilton? I've got it from one of your shops, actually, I think.
Colson Bassett.
Yeah, I really love Colson Bassett.
No, I do as well.
But that is completely different.
Yes.
It's very... saying it's manly is actually quite a good way of describing it. And slightly... It's not crumbly, but it's the texture's different. That's a really lovely creamy.
Well, it just sort of goes with all the other cheeses that you've had there, because you've had the creaminess of the Bix, and then you had that sort of slightly sort of woodiness of the Beaufort. So it made sense to actually put that on the on the plate. So when you're tasting the tasting wheel, that you've had a little bit of everything, and then you can go mad and try everything else. But you've gone through a good progression of taste, so that you've appreciated each one, and then enjoyed those, and found something nice to talk about.
And is this a fairly typical selection in terms of the different styles and flavours and textures?
I could have brought you know,
I'm sure
washed,
there's many combinations.
The washed rinds, which are really pungent, but it wouldn't be fair to
fill
the room.
Studio.
For our small studio, I don't think we'd any of our future.
Especially when we've got four boys in here already. Probably not what we want.
Thanks very much, Sue. I could just eat that all day.
Yes, I can. I'm going to have some more in a minute. So you've got your shop. You've got Highbury Park, and then you've got the one just off Marylebone High Street. I know you've just opened a new one as well. You started writing books and doing tastings. Do you feel that that's very much part of your mission? Is to, you know, people are intrigued. They do want to know where things come from. And I do think they want to learn about food. So is that a natural progression for you?
Yeah, I think when I first started, I got in touch with wine businesses, one in particular in Primrose Hill called Bibendum. And I took my Beaufort there and said, would you like to have the Beaufort when you're doing a wine tasting? And they said, oh, we'd love to. I said, I'm not going to even charge you. You know, just I want to see how it goes. And he said, well, why don't you come along and talk about it? So they were very, very encouraging of that whole idea. And then that's when I started doing tutorings of the cheese with the wine. And then I would do private events. Would you like to, instead of having a party, you know, just a wine and cheese party, would you like me to come and give you a little one-on-one?
Do you enjoy that, Patricia? Do you get a lot out of it?
Oh, I loved it.
Fantastic.
I mean, we do lots of them in the shop. We do loads of private parties and private events where they're coming for the cheese and wine, but then I just give a little talk. Or one of the guys does. I've got really great people that are working with me now, and I'm sort of, you know, they don't only wheel me out for certain things. But the books came about because I still do. I supply River Cafe with cheese, and I was doing a tasting at the restaurant for the whole staff, and it was the time when a very young chef called Jamie Oliver was working there. And he was terrific. He was the only one asking really pertinent questions. And I thought, oh, you're a cheeky chappy.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, I thought, that's it. He's great. And then suddenly he catapulted into this fame through, you know, the programme that...
The Naked Chef.
Yes.
Yeah, when he started.
And so he used to come to the shop all the time to get cheese. And then they came and did a bit of filming there as well. And then he introduced me to his book editor. I said, oh, I'd love to write a book. She said, send me in an idea. And I did. And she said, write it. So that's how it... It's never been as easy as that since.
No.
But at that time, it was just the right time.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's often how things pan out, you know, right time, right place, right
idea.
Absolutely.
You then published a second book in 2010.
Yeah.
And is that just explaining the different types of cheeses, how
they're
made,
how you
keep
them? Yes, I want the cheese room was my little homage to how it all started. It's a very sweet book, and it's still in print, and still people love it and send me emails about it, because it was very personal. But cheese was about my journey, really. Mm. It was where I've been, where I go, people, all the beautiful cheese people and the places.
And what you've learned.
What I've learned. And also because we were at Marylebone, we have an eating area. So I have a busy restaurant.
I've never managed
restaurant.
To be able to sit down there because it's always busy. I can never get a seat.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. But,
no, it's true.
You know, we were making all cheese-centric things. Not only that, but all the other produce that I was bringing in, all the fresh produce and the produce I'd found, like the hams and everything else that is local to all the places that I'm buying the cheese was coming into the shop. That's what fills the shop. And so we had these recipes, and I decided to put them into that book as well. I mean, it's a big book.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to allow Guy to sort of start, you know, round the wheel again in a minute for some cheese.
I think we need to take a break so I can really dig into this cheese.
Yeah, you do that. So I'm going to move over now to Albert and Russell. So you've got your, I mean, one of the, the best sorts of chocolate makers in the UK. I think there's a really nice handful of very respected chocolate makers.
I thought you were going to say they're one of the best kind because they're here and they've got
and
chocolate.
And also they're here. Now, just to describe your chocolates, your chocolate look like little pieces of works of art.
They are beautiful.
Particularly the ganache, which you'll describe in a minute. But you also do other things like bars and all sorts of other things. Do you want to just explain what you have in front of you? Because I think your latest, and you're going to like this, Patricia, I think your latest is a brie chocolate.
I've tasted it. Mm.
I haven't.
So just
explain what you've got there. And why do you do these things? Because you two are slightly barking mad.
It helps if you're a bit mad. For many years, we've eaten out at nice restaurants, and I just like it when chefs put together ingredients which you don't think will work together, and you try something on a plate and you try two different ingredients, and when they really work and it sort of sings in your mouth, it's kind of, you just feel so good. Mm-hmm. And I've had this passion for chocolate, and I've always wondered, will these things work with chocolate? And we've had other chocolatiers like Paul Young, who's been going for a while, has started doing with different ingredients, and I thought, well, I'm going to try that as well. For many years, I've always thought cheese. I love cheese.
I'm sure that can work with chocolate.
Yeah. I tried eating cheese with chocolate, and as Patricia was saying earlier on, it works. You can just eat a piece of cheese with chocolate and you can see whether it works. And I just wanted to do it. I've got in this box a brie chocolate. Now, I've tasted something different.
I've tasted loads of particularly your yuzu and pink peppercorn, and you do some miso chocolate.
I've got a mint and miso one in here as well, and
soy sauce chocolate, which I thought was going to be awful and tasted incredible.
I've tried that and it's really, really good. It's got that kind of salted caramelness, but on a whole new dimension.
It's like salted caramel, but it's got something extra to it as well. So you get
very kind of it's got that umaminess. Yeah.
But even you, I didn't think would do a cheesy chocolate. So can we have a little taste? Chocolate. And also, you're really setting yourself up here because you've got Patricia as a world expert, so I'm going to be very
interested.
It could go incredibly wrong. So just explain the ganache thing, how that works and why you do that in particular.
The ganache in the centre, because you've got the soft, it's that one there with the white and the milk chocolate.
That's the
brie one, yeah. Mm-hmm. The ganache, standard chocolate ganache is chocolate and fresh cream. It gives you a soft kind of centre, and then you can add your flavours to it and everything.
Which means you can really play.
Yeah, you can do. You can infuse flavours into the cream to make the ganache.
I've got one.
And with the brie one, it's actually taken me 3 years to get this right. I've been kind of attempting it, leaving it because it wasn't quite there. Brie is quite a difficult flavour to work with. You've got to balance it. You've got to get the flavour of the cheese. You need some acidity in there, and then that's got to work with the sweetness of the chocolate and everything. And I think when you get it right, it works.
Now, I've just done the thing I always do when I have one of your chocolates. I bite into it and I think, I know what's going to go on here. And then things happen which I don't really expect in my mouth. And then I normally get a third.
Yeah, you probably
afterwards.
Don't get the brie to start with.
Yeah, I was going to say,
you're probably getting the acidity that's in there as well. The brie will come through later. With the ganache, you tend to find that as the ganache, which has got chocolate in it, as it melts in your mouth, the flavours just develop. So it's a bit like drinking a wine. You find as the wine warms up in your mouth, the flavours develop in your mouth.
And the thing with you is what that I find is that you'll do a chocolate, it will have cheese or it will have peppercorns or whatever, but it's still a chocolate, and I don't know how to explain that. But although this is brie, it's still chocolate.
You're still getting the chocolate flavour.
Do you know what I mean?
That's part of the reason the brie is not too strong.
No.
When I was actually developing it, when I made the brie stronger, you were missing out on the chocolate. So the brie was a dominant flavour. And when you're eating a chocolate, basically it's the chocolate that's the star. You want to taste chocolate. Now, when the brie was too strong, you were missing that chocolate flavour. So I've just balanced it so you're getting the brie. But hopefully you can taste that fantastic Swiss milk
chocolate first
at the end.
Patricia, can I ask your views on that? It's a bit mad, isn't it?
No, it's not. I think that you could have been a bit braver with the cheese. I've just tasted some of the Bix with the residue of the chocolate in my mouth, and it's delicious.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try that.
I think you should be a little bit braver, honestly.
Yeah. I wonder if it's because we've been eating
cheese.
That's probably
a little bit unfortunate. That might have affected our taste buds a tiny bit.
A little bit, yeah. But that's
a good way to carry on. I mean, you've been eating cheese, so you narrow the cheese and chocolate. You're probably ready to taste the rest now because there's some different flavours.
Which is like starting with the goat's cheese to warm up your palate. Now we've transitioned from cheese to chocolate via a brie chocolate. Yes. So fantastic.
What other box of tricks have you got in there? These boys remind me of like Willy Wonka, you know, Willy Wonka's chocolate. Like a sort of magical...
I think a good one to try after that, probably stay on the slight savoury theme, is a mint and miso, which is the dark chocolate one there.
Mm. Mint and miso.
Yeah. We got this idea because, again, right, I was saying earlier on, we like to eat nice food in good restaurants. We were actually in a Japanese restaurant eating a lamb dish, which was lamb, mint and miso. And I knew mint works with chocolate. I've made a mint chocolate before. I've seen people put miso in a chocolate and they've won awards for that. And I thought, that obviously works with chocolate, so mint and miso. When I made a mint chocolate, I just thought it just needed something else. So I tried the mint and miso. The miso's got that umami kind of taste and everything, and it just worked.
No, it's really delicious.
Thank you. Really good.
Yeah, that is really good. Yeah. Mm. Tasting mint to start with, and then I've got the saltiness comes afterwards, and then I've got my chocolate hit again.
Yeah.
What I like about the mint at the end as well is that I love the way that you design how they each look.
They're like little sculptures, aren't
they?
All the chocolates are slightly different, either in the shape or the colour.
No, but they look so interesting.
Yeah, all our chocolates have got a story to them as well. Mm. It comes from either where we found the flavours, because we've done quite a lot of travelling around the world, so we may have been somewhere and I tasted some flavour for the first time, so we dedicate a chocolate to that city. With the mint and miso, we actually call it Sydney. Because there's big Asian influence in Australia. Also, the mould is very much like Sydney Opera House as well. So there's a small story behind all of our chocolates.
Now you've got a very luminous blue one there. Now everybody says that you should never do blue with food because human beings don't eat anything blue particularly. So tell us a story about that. What one's that one?
This one is blackcurrant and pernil. Mm. Now, this is going back to my youth when I started drinking in my late teens. I used up north... In Leeds, I used to love blackcurrant and pernil with some lemonade. I used to drink quite a lot of it. So that's kind of going back to my childhood. And someone asked me earlier on in the year, they wanted a blue chocolate because their company, everything was blue. So they wanted it to go with their
brand
or whatever. And I just made this blue chocolate. I just thought, wow, it just looks so nice. So I kind of wanted to do a blue chocolate. Now, blackcurrant, it's not quite black. It's kind of that dark blue. And I thought, the blue will fit with that. No problem at all.
That is very pernoy.
Yes,
is that
you've
a
got
word?
Pernoy in there as
pernoy.
Well.
I'm just but trying I'm to get all the different flavours.
Yeah, there's a lot. When you say a ganache is made from cream, this is actually more of a fruit ganache. There's more blackcurrant
like
in there.
Like a jelly in there.
Yeah, it's not a jelly. It's still
traditional
ganache with, it's got fruit and chocolate in there.
The texture's a little bit jellyish, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a bit more to it. Not sure that's my favourite, that one. But that's
well, you don't like white chocolate, though, do you?
No, it's the white chocolate
thing. I don't like pernil either.
I don't like the aniseed flavour.
No, not
it's
my
quite subtle, though, is aniseed, because normally I hate aniseed, so anything, you know, I'm drawing a blank on them now. I think I've got a chocolate high, but, you know, all of those, the other spirits with very heavy aniseed
Sambuca and all of those kind of things.
Horrible, but this is very, very light.
Yeah, well, I don't like to add too much flavour because I want you to taste the chocolate.
Yeah.
I mean, the white chocolate in this is from the Dominican Republic. So you're getting that nice white chocolate there. It's not too sweet as a chocolate either. Hopefully you can taste that chocolate as well as the pernil and the blackcurrant.
Oh, yeah,
I like to take people on the journey when they're eating a chocolate. They're not just having blackcurrant. They've got blackcurrant and the pernil. They all come through at different times.
Together,
and you also get the white chocolate. You can't forget about that.
And what's our final square one?
Finally,
then?
This is a new one, banana cardamom.
Caramel. It's a caramel.
Yes, this is a caramelism, so a different texture altogether.
How much do you have to do with this, Albert? Do you just your ideas bounce off each other?
We do. So we try to say some flavours that he'll come up with and say it's absolute bonkers.
Yeah.
Some of them I'll try and say, he used to say he would dismiss it as well. This one is quite interesting. This one's called Rio de Janeiro. It actually is something that we went to Rio last Christmas and we thought, let's do banana chocolate. And because in Rio they use a lot of spices as well, and thought, okay, let's just add cardamom in it. And this one came very naturally.
The cardamom really works with the banana.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This one actually works really well. It really does.
We just won the world silver for this chocolate.
Not surprised.
Really interesting.
This one came so naturally. Everything came so naturally because usually it takes about, sometimes it takes 3 months. Some of the chocolate takes 3 years to develop.
Yeah.
Wow. This one took 2 months and we nailed it, I think.
Just straight away.
Yeah, it's just everything came in. Yeah, everything just lined up very nicely for this chocolate.
I don't even know how to explain that one.
Oh, it's just like an exotic holiday.
There you go.
Some people say they don't like bananas, they're not keen on bananas, or they don't like the cooked bananas, but they've tried this chocolate and they say it's gorgeous. They love it.
And you've started branching out into some other things. So it's not just the beautiful box of chocolates that you can get from your website and other places. You've also started... You know, because you can't content yourself, can you? Let's face it.
Right. They're like mad scientists. They just keep inventing things.
Life is an adventure. It's a challenge. If you've got nothing to work for, what's the point? You don't just stop. Absolutely. You always keep working. So with the caramels, I'm very good at making caramels and winning some good awards for the caramels. And people were saying to us, we just love your caramels. Why don't you put it in a bottle? So that people give you ideas sometimes. Yeah. I thought, well, why not? Let's try selling the caramels. One chocolate we mentioned earlier on is soy caramel. It's using soy sauce in the caramel. And it's kind of our version of a salted caramel. You've got the natural saltiness from the soy sauce. And you've just got that extra flavour of the soy sauce in there. And it works really well. So we're now doing that in a jar, which you can taste now.
So what would you put it on, a biscuit or toast?
You can put it on all sorts. You can just eat it as you are. You can spread it on a biscuit, spread it on toast. My favourite is just that soy caramel on vanilla ice cream.
I really like that. It's got that saltiness to it.
But it's not overpowering saltiness either.
I can imagine on ice cream, ice cold ice cream.
Actually, carrying on from the banana, one of my absolute favourite is a crepe with some cooked bananas, vanilla ice cream, and that just on the top is just gorgeous.
No, that would be great on ice cream.
It is.
You can actually use it on savoury food as well. So in the summer, we did quite a bit of barbecue. So what we did is chicken wings, and then the last 5 minutes, just brush it on top and just grill it for an extra 5 minutes to give that extra glaze to it.
Oh, I bet that would be great.
And what's your other one there? Look, of course, has won another taste award.
Yuzu, your favourite. They've all got great taste awards for this.
Yeah, so what is yuzu?
Yuzu is a Japanese citrus fruit. So it's best way to describe it is like a very intense lemon and lime mixed together. So you really get that zing of the citrus fruit in there. We use quite a lot of
You like that in your chocolates, don't you?
Yeah, we do.
That's almost like lemon curd.
You get it.
Yeah, it's like caramel, but you've got that fruitness to it as well. So it's not just a caramel. You've just got something else with it.
It tastes like a tart citron.
The lemon curdy bit in the middle.
I was thinking that inside a pancake would be absolutely lovely.
I find something like this, if you make a Victoria sandwich cake, and just make a buttercream and add this to the buttercream, you just get that nice yuzu flavour. I've tried that.
I can see Patricia making all sorts of notes here in her head because she loves cooking. So you've got these jars now, and you've got your box of chocolates. And I know you do choc witches and tablets. What are they?
The choc witch is our idea. So I think Albert came up with that idea in New York, didn't you?
Yeah, it was when we first started the company. One day I just walked down 6th Avenue in New York and thought, I need a choc witch, it needs to look like that. So when I got home, I just explained to Russell, say, right, we need to develop this product called choc witch. It's got to have two discs of chocolates with either marshmallow or pâte de fruits layer. So when you bite into that, you get a crunch of chocolate, but then you get that softness in the middle because we really love food that has a good contrast in texture.
Yeah.
You can tell by what we've eaten already.
So that's how we came up with the idea, is like choc witch. So yeah, so we do three different flavors, marshmallows and three different flavours in pâte de fruits. So we've got six of them.
And your tablets?
Tablets, they are all just chocolate bars.
They're single origin chocolate bars.
All our chocolates that we use, they're single origin, and we only use fine flavoured cacao. Now, what that means is most of the chocolate that you get in the world They're from Africa or from other places where the flavour is just chocolatey. Fine flavoured cacao, when you eat it, they've got its own flavour. Yeah. And less than 20% of the world's chocolate are fine flavour. Mm. A lot of it coming from South America, some of them from Madagascar, some of them from Indonesia, and also now from Vietnam as well. So you need to look out for that. But a lot of the stuff that you get, maybe like in Ivory Coast and Ghana, they wouldn't be classed as fine flavour. Mm. So we only use the fine flavour cacao. We've got seven different bars here.
Now, I know that before you came on the programme, I didn't get a taste of this. You've bought a bar of chocolate with you that isn't yours. It's not yours, is it?
No, so this was the Food Talk team went to the chocolate show recently, and I was chatting to our producer Lucy before we started recording today, and she said, "Oh, try this. I found this really interesting chocolate. I'm sure you'll like it." And she gave me a piece and said, "Try this." Yeah. And I put it in my mouth. And then I was very, very confused.
So this bar actually is from a Taiwanese company, a Taiwan company called Fuwan Chocolates. They make, now I don't even realize that in Taiwan they grow their own cacao as well.
Oh,
and
really?
They've won a lot of awards this year at the International Chocolate Awards. They basically sweep the board in the Asia Pacific round. So one of the guys, Warren, who's a chef in Taiwan, and he made this bar. It's made of pink shrimp.
White chocolate and pink.
Can you bring yourself or not?
I'm going to smell it.
You're going to try it.
I don't think I can
eat it. It's not chocolatey. There's
almonds in there as well. Cool. But it was very confusing when I tasted that. What do you think, Sue?
Well, it's not chocolate. It tastes like it's nutty. It's almost like nut brittle but soft in a way. It's not like chocolate at all. I really don't find
it's
that very
horrible.
Nice. I don't find that nice at all.
No. I'm sorry. But
it's horrible. I don't like the taste.
They do another bar actually with shrimp, but it's a Thai curry shrimp.
No,
this one you have to bear in mind that, you know, like I thought I had the same sort of feelings, like nope. And Russell also said nope, absolutely not. But Russell, you tried it, isn't it?
Yeah, I tried it. It was actually delicious.
I'm not going there.
It's not the kind of thing I think I would eat with another box of chocolates.
No.
I couldn't find a place, but I think on its own it was actually delicious.
Definitely not going for that one. Right, I'm really sorry, but we've run out of time, would you believe? So that's Russell Pullen and Albert Chow. And if you're interested in their chocolates, and if you haven't tried them, you really, really,
really
should.
They're fantastic.
5dchocolates.com. People can get them online, can't they? But you've got loads and loads of other outlets. And if you go on your website, it shows you there. We love what you do. And I love the fact that you just constantly, and you can tell you're still really enjoying it. And I think that's the secret, really.
Yeah, after 4 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if anybody has never been to La Fromagerie, then you haven't lived.
Have to get down there.
You've got
amazing
to
amazing cheese.
And of course, you can order stuff online, but actually, you really should go and have a look. So there's three shops. One in Marylebone, one in Highbury, one in Bloomsbury. You need to go along there. And thank you very much to Patricia Michelson.
Thank you.
I know you're so busy. And it's a real treat. And the cheese that you bought, oh my goodness, that was
stunning. Finish it off now.
And I've just found my new favourite one. That's my new favourite one. And again, if you go to lafromagerie.co.uk, you can find all about Patricia and her books and her wonderful stores. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show. We're now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield, all over the place. Can't even bother to list them out today. And thank you very much to my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge of Food Rush. You had it well. You enjoyed this one, didn't you?
Oh, it was a cracker. It was. I've been away for a few weeks, but it was a great one to come back for.
I'm going to sit down and eat a load of cheese now. If you want to recommend any future guests, or you think somebody's doing something groundbreaking in the food sector, please get in touch with us at at Food Talk Show. And if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week, everybody. Bye.